Thank you for listening to Mormon Sex Info. This episode is an archived episode and is only now becoming publicly available. Mormon Sex Info relies on contributions. To contribute, please visit mormonsex.info. And now, please enjoy this episode.
So going back really fast to the diagnostic criteria, where we started, let's just kind of state very clearly. So if you're having low libido with your husband or low arousal, but find yourself very aroused in other situations, that would not apply to this.
Now for arousal, but for desire, yeah, right? Because if you have low desire for your husband, but you're also not having a desire to masturbate, you're not having a desire to have sex with anyone else, you don't even think about it anymore. And oh my God, where did it go?
Right.
That is hypoactive sexual desire.
Right. So it's not contingent on a certain person or a certain situation. It's really general.
No, it's like, yeah, right. In fact, if it is contingent on a particular person, especially the one you've been living with for the last 20 years, I think it's, you don't have HSDD. What you have is a problem communicating sexually with your partner. And certainly, there's no medical doctor around that would say, oh, here's your prescription for Addy. Go home and take it and see what happens. What they're going to do much more likely is give you a referral to a psychologist or to a sex therapist and say, you know, there's stuff you got to do. There's stuff you got to do to make yourselves be 16 again and go dating. And that's easy to do. You just have to kind of commit to do it and not see this person as an old fuddy-duddy, but see this person as a sexual being who actually might be way more interesting than you think, right? I mean, that was the classic in Master and Johnson, right? They would bring these couples in. Their therapy would be to bring these couples to St. Louis, right? Not exactly the sexiest place on earth, and have them hold up in a motel where they're going to be sleeping with each other, but not allowed to touch each other, right? So that whole first week is exploring everybody's fantasies and their ideas. And, you know, you're in this very sex positive situation. So it's okay to open up, and you do. And lo and behold, here's this couple who haven't touched each other in 16 years. And he's discovering that, you know, she actually wants to be tied up, and she's discovering that he really kind of would like to be wearing sort of crotchless panties while it happens. And oh my God, she's kinkier than I ever thought. And oh my God, he's kinkier than I ever thought. They still can't touch each other. There's all these other hot people talking about their fantasies. And so you're in this incredible, you know, sort of cauldron of arousal. And now the second week, you get to start concentrating on the neck, concentrating on the earlobes, concentrating on nipples, concentrating on kissing. You know, and all that before you actually get any kind of genital stimulation. And by the end of the second week, go for it. Let the floodgates open. And these people report having sex like they did when they were much younger. Because again, they've had to rediscover their subjective arousal, right? Not just the genital arousal, but the thing that really turns them on. And sometimes, you know, for a woman, sometimes just being listened to can be an incredible turn on. Just being listened to. You know, so what do you like sexually? I mean, I don't know that I'd recommend asking that on a first date, but whatever.
Right. But
what do you, you know, so once you guys got to know each other, okay, talk is going to go to sex because you're dating. So what's your strangest fantasy, or what's the strangest thing you've ever done, or what's the most erotic thing you've ever done? Or, you know, what do you like to look at? What do you like to see? There's so many ways. So many ways to gain that back. So if you can gain it back, you don't have HSDD. But if after trying to do this, trying the mindfulness therapy, if you're kind of too anxious about it, you do something that reduces the anxiety, so you try to be in the moment, you're still not feeling it. And it's not because, you know, he's not a willing participant. He is, and he's trying. You know, at that point, I think you need some intervention that is much more physiological, again, to kind of jumpstart the system.
Okay, so let's talk about that. Let's talk about this med and what you know about it, because it's had a lot of interesting conflicting reports, right?
Oh,
especially
yeah.
in the media. I mean, it's been touted the best thing ever since birth control pill for women's health. And then, you know, on the other side of the spectrum, it's like, this is the farciest thing possible. How would you ever be able to help a woman's libido with
I think it's interesting that
pharmacological product, right? So, yes.
Right. And I think it's interesting that much of what's been written has not been written by anybody who's actually been on it. Which I find that very interesting, right? Because I think when you ask women who've been on it, especially those who've been on it long enough that it's actually had an effect, the responders swear by it. Now, you have some that are non-responders, but they may have a different problem. So you can think of HSDD, and this is just kind of as a little bit of background, is either a bottom-up problem or a top-down problem. Bottom-up, kind of a lack of ascending excitement that activates desire. And top down as too much inhibition, you know, too much frontal lobe function. You're thinking about 80 million things at the same time that you'd really want sex to just be, you know, something to get over with really, really quickly because now you got to go cooking or you got to take kids to soccer or, you know, whatever it is. And you're not in the moment. So it's much too much top down inhibition as opposed to too little bottom up excitation. Knowing that, there's two ways in. One is to amp the excitation, and the other is to blunt the inhibition. And so this first drug, Addy, or its real name is flibanserin, it kind of puts the brakes on your brain's serotonin systems. So if serotonin is involved in satiety under normal circumstances, having overactive inhibition will then blunt your ability to be in the moment. So you're less likely to be spontaneous. You're less likely to go for it. You're less likely when you're in it to actually be able to concentrate on it because you're just not feeling it. You're off, you know, trying to organize the next part of your day or you're, you know, how early you have to wake up tomorrow to bring the kids to school. I mean, whatever it is, it's like you're not there. And just like you're not there after you've had a, you know, the number of orgasms you need in order to be satisfied. I mean, you're not there sexually anymore. Somebody may still want to have sex with you and you're just, I'm done. You're done. And so having that be online all the time is kind of what Addy goes after or what flibanserin goes after. But putting the brakes on sort of serotonin's ability to activate inhibition in the brain, you're now disinhibiting. But you don't do it at once. You do it over time. So people are on the drug every day, usually before they go to bed, and not go to bed to have sex, but go to bed to go to sleep. That way, if there is any syncope, you're already in bed. So you're not really going to faint. You're going to just, you know, be in bed, lying down. So nothing will really happen, just like it wouldn't happen with an antihistamine. Now, what kind of effects does the drug have? Well, it's got major effects on desire. So if you use, for example, the desire components in the female sexual function inventory as a primary endpoint, the drug actually elevates them nicely and significantly. But again, over time. So you can't just take it once and have it be done. So in that way, you know, people calling it a female Viagra are actually doing enormous amount of disservice to the concept of desire. I mean, desire is not all or none. It's in gradations. And for you to have lived for a very long period with no desire, now to have desire again is going to take a bit of a while for it to come back. So the drug produces by, you know, blocking that inhibition, it actually allows the excitatory systems to now kind of reintegrate themselves. And once you start feeling it, the responders really start feeling it. The ones that still have too little excitation, they're not really affected by it all that much. And of course, in the studies that were done, they weren't weeded out. Okay, you just had women with HSDD. You don't know why they have HSDD or what the symptomatology might be at a brain level, at a neurochemical level. So, you know, if that's true, then you're mixing your apples and your oranges. So you got some women who are responders, some that are non-responders, and the non-responders are going to now weigh everything down in terms of the actual efficacy of the compound. Now, mix that with the fact that the effect on desire was much greater than the effect on the what the FDA imposed from their very male model of something they call SSEs, or sexually satisfying events. And the SSE was, according to the FDA, the patient, you know, sort of patient-centered gold standard. Well, it's certainly a male-centered gold standard. I mean, how many times? It's a bean counting measure, right? But women have throughout history had desire and not had sex, or had no desire but had sex. So desire and actually having sex are not the same thing.
Right.
It, so the SSE came out of the early studies on Viagra or sildenafil. So men, you know, gee, if I have an erection, I can actually have sex. So the number of sexually satisfying events is going to go up, and go up, you know, in a whopping sort of way. Okay, that's great, because they didn't have a desire disorder. So now we're imposing something from an arousal disorder onto a desire disorder. And we're doing it to a gender that has learned that sex can occur irrespective of desire, or sex cannot occur irrespective of desire. So that's not exactly the right end point. Understanding if they would like to have sex. I mean, maybe they would, but the situation just isn't calling for it, or the person they're with isn't, you know, doing what he needs or she needs to do to arouse them properly or to excite them properly. So, you know, if that's your final point, and that point goes up on average over placebo one time more per month, you could look at that and say, as the FDA did, is that really, even though it's statistically significant, is that a significant event for women? And they argued that point, right? And yes, it's statistically significant, that's true, but it's over a fairly high placebo effect. So, you know, the question is, well, okay, the placebo effect is there in women, you know, who are heard. Now, where it was huge, though, was in a distress scale. So how distressed are you by the lack of desire? Well, when the number of SSEs go up and the desire goes up, the distress actually goes down. And that takes a fairly long time to happen. Like, we're talking being on the drug every day for a few weeks before that change now begins to kind of take root in the brain. Okay. So what ADDIE does is it really just reestablishes whatever your original baseline was. It doesn't make you, you know, hypersexual. It doesn't make you want to do the football team. It doesn't make you want to do something you wouldn't normally do, right? It's just kind of reestablishing whatever your normal was. And, you know, if your normal was a lot, it reestablishes a lot. If your normal was a little, it reestablishes a little, right? It's not something that's going to make you really want to, you know, immediately go home and have sex. There are other compounds, the ones that are kind of activating excitation, that might actually override the inhibition and make you feel that way. And there are two others that are in clinical trials now. One's called bremelanotide by Palatin, and the other is called Librido by a company in the Netherlands called Emotional Brain. And again, these are small biotech companies, right? They have to farm out to somebody big in order to actually get it on the market. Right, these companies can't do that by themselves because they're too tiny. I mean, even Boehringer, by definition, isn't Pfizer. It's not Merck. It's not, you know, Valeant. It's not these big, humongous monster companies that they need to partner with in order to actually get something on the market and get it into the pharmacies. So, you know, these little companies are not going to do it on their own, right? So ultimately, bremelanotide is going to have to be partnered with somebody big, and Librido is presumably going to have to be partnered with somebody big. But what these drugs do is amp the excitation. So they're acting in a fundamentally different way, and usually to amp dopamine in particular, and noradrenaline, but they're amping in a very different way and overriding the inhibition, because excitation does have a kind of a cool way of doing that. With Libido, it's a testosterone-coated Viagra. And that's interesting because the people that put this out had done original studies. In fact, their studies came from really good science and not just serendipity. The interesting thing about bremelanotide is that it was actually tested in rats first in my lab before it actually went to be tested in humans. And it actually made female rats solicit sex from males, even when they didn't, you know, they were on a baseline that where their solicitations would almost be zero. They solicited a lot, right? And it was an acute effect, so it can be taken on demand. And again, that's going to, you know, that's going to be different for different women. Some will want something they take every day and not think about it. Others are going to want something they take on demand because maybe they just have sex few and far in between. So when they're in a sexual circumstance, they're going to want to amp that, right? The Libido is cool because – so we've heard, oh, you know, yeah, Viagra didn't work in women. Actually, Viagra does work in women. It produces beautiful vaginal engorgement. But women don't show that they're perceiving that vaginal engorgement and perceiving it in a way that men with erectile dysfunction do as making them want to have sex. So
because
in that way
– part of that arousal, not interest.
Exactly, right? So in that way, Viagra didn't work. And you know, when Pfizer was doing those studies in women in the early part of I guess it was the early 1998 or 99 when they did those studies, they just said, okay, no more. We're not doing it anymore because it clearly doesn't work, right? But it produces beautiful engorgement. Well, it turns out that if you have a vanishingly small dose of testosterone that mimics the amount of testosterone that your ovaries release the morning of ovulation, 4 hours after, not three, not two, but four and for the next eight, your brain is actually unconsciously receptive to your vaginal arousal. And it uses that as a way of, I guess, saying that, oh yeah, the body's ready. Bring on the stimulation. Mm. And so in a way, it's almost like teasing your brain into thinking you're ovulating. And you can do this on a daily basis.
Which is a time that women do tend to feel a little hornier.
Exactly. So testosterone is either being converted to estradiol in the brain or it's acting on its own or both. But it's clearly doing something over someone's own estrogen that is now amplifying the ability of the Viagra to let probably the hypothalamus know that you are ready to go. And being ready to go when you're ovulating is a really, really, really big way to activate your interest in someone. Now, someone still has to be there. I mean, obviously, if there's nothing there to stimulate the interest, you're just going to be kind of all dressed up with nowhere to go. But if there is someone there to stimulate the interest will in fact be stimulated. And you actually end up with more SSEs on this one than you do on the others. Hmm. But I mean, that's what happens when you ovulate too. I mean, the chance of having desire and having sex are kind of merged together, you know, especially if it's a weekend or a time with, you know, when it would be more conducive to having sex.
Right.
So yeah, so I mean it's an interesting sort of way that these things are coming out, that you've got underactive excitation and overactive inhibition. And modeling those systems in rats, of course, is what my work is largely consisting of, trying to figure out how can you, you know, what's a tangible target for a physiological system or for a drug, right? And once you know what that is, well, lo and behold, guess what? Everything that's out there has simply been kind of reaffirming this view of the you know, this kind of dual control mechanism that I think really exists in there and that can go awry when either there's too much inhibition, kind of top down, or too little excitation, kind of bottom up.
Hmm. But as of now, the only product that's on the market is the Addy. Is that correct?
Is the Addy. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So these are all coming out possibly in the next, what, like we're talking about next year, 10 years?
Well, probably, well, I would say within the next three.
Okay.
Because both of them are in phase three trials. So they're going to go to the FDA and say, okay, here's the results of the phase three. Let's have a meeting. And certainly the dose of testosterone is really small. We're talking about 25 micrograms. It's a really small dose. You put it under your tongue, it goes right to your brain. It doesn't do anything peripherally. They can't find a trace of it in the periphery. So there's nothing that's peripheral. And certainly, and with bremelanotide, it's an injectable, so a bit like insulin. So you would inject it into your leg, and off you go. I mean, the injector actually doesn't barely feel it, but it's a good way to get it in. And because it's subcutaneous, it really minimizes any kind of risk of flushing and heart attack or anything like that. So you really, you know, you'd have to be shooting this stuff up your nose or into your bloodstream directly in order to get any kind of a side effect that would be untoward or, you know, toward, you know, something being unhealthy for you. What's going to be interesting, though, is to see if the FDA is going to put the same restrictions on both of these that are put on flibanserin, because, you know, it's right now you've got there's a whole REMS program that's there to minimize the risk of the syncope. And I mean, you know, number one, it's not a horrible risk. In fact, it's probably not even a risk. And in the phase three trials, it wasn't even significantly different from control. So whether it's a risk or not, the REMS program means that you got to find a REMS certified doctor to prescribe it for you. And you got to go pick it up from a REMS certified pharmacy. So I remember a woman in the New York Times Review wrote about her attempt to get it. She had to go to Connecticut. Mm-hmm. So she had to drive like an hour and 45 minutes away from her apartment in New York City in order to actually pick it up.
Goodness.
So how many women are going to do that? And, you know, Valeant got it, and then they upped the price of it. So, I mean, that's what drug companies do. You know, if you really wanted to make a lot of women – be dependent on something, you'd lower the price and offer it to as many women as possible, right? But Valeant's even doing the opposite of that. So I mean, so much for big bad pharma trying to enslave women into taking a drug for their desire. It's like they're making it out of the reach of a lot of women who will have HSDD, and the FDA has created the REMS program that puts it, you know, out of the reach of women who actually have things to do on any given day, which is kind of ridiculous.
Right.
I mean, yeah. can you imagine if they'd done that to Viagra?
Well, this is what's like, so fascinating, right, is the differences between the gender issues of medications and sexual health and accessibility to products.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we're just not letting women be in control of their sexuality. I find that, I mean, that's probably one of the most disgusting things that I think I've ever seen. And I'm not even a woman, but to me, it's like, why not? Like, women aren't going to be, you know, as many women will buy snake oil as men will. So why are we being so patriarchal and paternalistic and trying to protect women against themselves and against their ability to make a decision that, you know, they may want to make?
Right.
I don't know. It really drives me crazy. It's like women are not children. They're not, oh, that's okay. That's okay, dear. Why don't you go get me another cup of coffee? I mean, no, that's not what women are. They never were. But you go back to the 1950s when father knew best. And honestly, were women that even then? Like, I don't think so.
Right.
I think, you know, so to me, just,
the journals of our ancestors don't seem to.
No, they don't
agree
do that.
With that. Yeah,
that's right. So I don't know where. I mean, this is hopefully the last vestige of, you know, macho culture where men have to protect women and women have to protect women, and you know, and then you just got everybody protecting you and nobody listening to you, and that is an anathema, I think.
So going back to the med itself, you said, you know, you might see some results after 2 or 3 weeks of taking it, especially if the problem was pretty severe to begin with. After that, is it something you continue to take, or is it just something you take until your desire comes back, or is that independently?
No, that's an interesting question. So these are some of the phase four studies that they're gonna have to do. So in a phase four study, you move beyond just the actual phenomenon. So the question is, can you be on it, jumpstart the system, and then go off it having the system now working, kind of like you've recharged your battery? Or will it be the case that you go off it and the desire plummets? Right? So, I mean, you know, it's kind of like treatment-resistant versus non-resistant depression. I mean, some depression is treatable, some isn't. And some people, when they get treatment, when they go off the meds, become depressed instantly. And others, they go off the meds and they don't get depressed again. Mm-hmm. So I think it's going to be a similar kind of thing to that where, you know, we're just going to have to do it and, you know, run some phase four clinical trials on it to make sure that you know, women who go off it, if they want to go off it, can go off it in a managed way and actually see whether they lose it again or whether, you know, they have enough bottom-up excitation to sustain it. So okay. I think we don't know the answer. We don't know the answer to that yet.
Okay. And does it matter if you're pre- or post-menopausal as far as some of the effects? Do we know that?
Well, it's been the FDA approved it only for premenopausal women, but there is a huge cohort now of women who are postmenopausal who have been prescribed it off-label. Now, a lot of these women are getting estrogen replacement at the same time, so we don't know if it works, you know, with or without estrogen replacement, but it clearly works just as well as it does in the premenopausal women. So I think it's probably going to be again another phase four trial where people go back to the FDA and say, okay, gee, look at the effects. It seems to work in the postmenopausals, and then you know the FDA will likely give the green light for it to be approved for postmenopausal women. So then, you know, doctors won't be prescribing it off label.
Okay. And do you know offhand if insurance companies tend to pay for this type of treatment?
Well, again, that depends on, you know, depends on where you are. I live in Canada where we have a socialized medicine system and the insurance companies pay for it. It's probably going to depend state by state. There may be some states where the insurance company pays for it, some states where it doesn't. It may also depend on what your private insurance actually consists of, right? I mean, right now it's expensive. And so I could easily imagine insurance companies not wanting to touch it with a 10-foot pole. But I could imagine that if the price came down and if the thing were severe and if, you know, I mean, some women that have HSDD kill themselves. Now, insurance companies, of course, have a clause that says if you kill yourself, your insurance policy doesn't work anymore. But I'd venture to guess that if they understand that sex is a part of a woman's life and a very strong part of her self-identity and that, you know, if the desire to have it goes away, the distress, the relationship issues, the stress on the relationship, the stress on the individual can sometimes push them over an edge. And nobody wants to be guilty of helping that along. So I think insurance companies would probably do very, very well to cover it. And again, you know, you have data from Viagra studies. I mean, men who are diagnosed with ED in their 40s, if they actually take Viagra or, you know, Cialis or any of the fills, they take these fill drugs, lo and behold, their chance of having a heart attack in their 60s and 70s goes down by 70%.
Hmm.
Now, you know why that happens? Because now they have their erections, they're sexual again. To be sexual and maintain that, these guys all start working out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And they start getting healthy. They quit smoking. They stop, you know, eating crap. They start getting healthy. And in doing that in your 40s, you end up then preventing heart attack. So the idea that, oh, well, you know, it's a lifestyle drug, it's a lifestyle thing. It's not like pain where it's not a lifestyle. Well, you know, lifestyle is a very important predictor of any kind of medical malady.
Right.
And if you want to reduce the strain on the system as people get older, then you got to be preventative, right? And, you know, if you increase your sexual health, you're going to increase your health in general, which makes you less of a burden on the system rather than more of a burden. So the question is it worth the money to do that? I think so.
Absolutely. This is where it's just so important to understand that sexuality is absolutely an integral part of of your overall health. Exactly.
Absolutely.
And it just drives me mad when people are talking about lifestyle and I don't want to pay for this or that because that's just a luxury item.
Goodness, yeah.
Grief.
Well, I mean, you know, I don't think people's sexual lives are luxuries. Mm-hmm. You know, they're, it's that's like saying, oh, you know, eating, that's the luxury. Well, No. You know, oh, well, but sex is only for making babies. Well, if that's what you think sex is, then having sex and not making a baby is a luxury. Sex is way more than just that.
Well, it ties to our emotional and spiritual and just every part of physiological health. I mean, it's just such a, especially as you know, we're in a sense talking to a Mormon audience, this is where obviously sometimes we get quagmired is this idea, well, sex is not a need and you need to control your appetites and desires. And a lot of religious cultures have that, obviously that rhetoric. At the same time, sexuality is an integral part of who we are as humans. And there's a lot of sex positivity in Mormonism that makes space for that. But again, we're very controlling about when in your life or with who
absolutely
do that, you know, express your sexuality with.
No, absolutely. And I mean, again, it's something that women have learned to express a certain way, men have learned to express a different way, and you know, they need to find out where that middle ground is. And where the middle ground is where they can explore each other's deepest, maybe even darkest fantasies. Because fantasies are fantasies, that's all. But you know, you do that with the person rather than against the person, and now you're talking. Right? I mean, that can bring two people together in ways that they weren't even together when they were 16 as high school sweethearts.
Right. The maturity in the passionate embrace, in a sense.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, I mean, I think that, you know, I think these drugs are ultimately to be used in conjunction with therapy, as adjuncts to therapy, as things that will kind of spur you on in order for the therapy now to be much more effective. And, you know, in no way does it have to be, you know, a therapy enterprise versus a medical enterprise. I think it doesn't need to be two companies competing with each other. I think it's much better to think of it as, you know, two sides of the same coin that both need to be in good health.
One thing I just want to very quickly clarify, because we talked about genital pain, and that being its own disorder. At the same time, I just wanted to make sure we understand that obviously if you're having an arousal disorder and you're not engorging, you're not lubricating, probably genital pain is going to be part of the equation. So how do you, the egg or the chicken that comes first? Is that kind of how?
Yeah, no, I think it is. That? And I think, yeah, I mean, I think those two things do play on each other. You know, because general vaginismus versus dyspareunia. So vaginismus would be that painful entry. The dyspareunia would be the actual searing pain that you can get without even something being inside. So I think you need to know which one has always been there. Is it there when you put a finger inside? Is it there when you put, you know, a small von Frey hair inside? Or was it a situationally specific thing that, say, a guy with a giant massive penis just hurt you when you weren't even into it and you weren't really into it and you weren't that lubricated, so you weren't that ready, and he just rammed it in and lo and behold. But you know, it's funny, because if that hasn't happened to you before, it's going to become quite specific to that person and not necessarily generalized to your whole sexuality. That's just a good thing, that how experience kind of tells the brain how the world works, right? So if this is the first time it's happened and you're 40 and, you know, this guy is just a jerk and, you know, tried to take it from you, probably you're never going to go out with him again. But you're not necessarily going to think that this is something that might happen again. Yeah, again, but if you're the type of person who is much more, you know, kind of obsessive about things, and you are worrying about, you know, chronically anxious and worrying about things that might happen again and again and again, then you might be the type of person for whom that one situation could make you anticipate that it could happen again. But, you know, again, humans tend to be much more sort of individual specific. You know who's the nice people, you know who are the jerks, you know who are the funny people, you know who are the, you know, the people who you're with for 2 seconds and all of a sudden you're as sad as they are. So, you know, we tend to group the world into those sort of uber criteria and uber groupings. So probably this guy would be grouped into the bad sex category as opposed to the good sex category. But again, that's assuming you've had good sex.
Right, and sometimes these things can happen even with somebody that isn't necessarily a jerk or that you like quite a bit but isn't experienced, you know, like honeymoon sex that
right.
a lot of Mormons have the first sexual experiences, you know, and are kind of unprepared or maybe haven't even allowed for a lot of the arousal or building up process. And so all of a sudden to go from pretty much, you know, holding hands to being naked and having sex together can be a problem in some of those regards as well.
No, absolutely.
Okay, yeah. Well, I've had you on much longer than I had anticipated, but I'm just enthralled with all this information. It's been super useful, super informative. I just love all of this, kind of delving into a much deeper level of understanding of our brains and how that obviously takes such a big part of who we are and how
oh, yeah.
we interact and how we have sex and arousal, all these things. So I'd love to open it up to closing thoughts. Is there anything I didn't ask that you'd like to make sure we cover? And what would you like to leave us with?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, like anything, sex is something you experience for your own pleasure and your own gratification. You got to own it. You got to own it. When you're doing things for other people all the time, you can get lost in that. And I think sex is something too precious to get lost in any other human being. That said, when you're with another human being, knowing how that human being works, discovering, you know, sort of cultivating the landscape, as it will, is something that if both people enter into it with that in mind, chances are you're going to really discover so many new and innovative and wonderful ways to gratify each other that it's like every time is different. And people, I think that's the hallmark of relationships that actually stay together, is that people are not only respective of each other's time, but they make time for sex because it's an important part of the relationship. It's not, you know, it's so many people that get together and they say, oh, well, now we're together. We don't have to date anymore, you know, because we've done that. Right, the honeymoon sex that you talked about, we've done that. So now we're together. We can have it whenever we want, which means whenever he wants, mostly. So I think the ones that still continue to date, that still continue to make time for sex, maybe even make naughty time for sex because, you know, they just put the kids to bed and now they're going to go and try to be really quiet down in the basement, you know, that can increase arousal. So you know, you got to make time for it, just like you make time for going to a restaurant or having food or going to a concert or, you know, going to church. Whatever it is, you make time for it. So you're together. Don't take it for granted.
I love that. And just a little caveat for my LDS audience. I mean, I know that Dr. Faust talked about a lot of different possibilities, a lot of interactions that maybe wouldn't necessarily fall under our standards of when or with who or how to have sex. But I really didn't even want to interrupt that for that because I think the information was really super helpful. And just making sure that if you're sensitive to those kinds of things, that you're able to look through and past that, because the underlying principles he's talking about are exactly what will be helpful to really any relationship and regardless of the value system that you come from. So thank you again so much for your time. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it, and this was phenomenal.
Great.
After ending the recording, Dr. Faust and I kept talking, and I realized that he was still talking about pretty interesting things, so I decided to hit the record button again and got permission from him to add this last clip. It starts kind of in the middle of where we were talking, so it's not a totally smooth transition, but I thought I would offer these last few thoughts that I was able to record. He's just such an interesting man and is so knowledgeable about some of these topics. So hope you enjoy.
Still can get as interestingly naughty and kinky as they want. I mean, I'm always reminded of the fact that the largest number of internet orders to Fredericks of Hollywood comes from the Middle East.
Mm.
Okay, so you wonder, what's somebody wearing under that burqa? Well, guess what?
Yeah.
Right? So, you know, there are ways of doing it that respect the culture, respect the religious precepts, but can still be incredibly gratifying, right? And in fact, guilt is a good guilt. Being guilty, taking your guilty pleasures, can sometimes be a really good driver of arousal. Mm. We shouldn't do it here, but really, what's to say we can't?
Right.
And now you've done it in the office, or you've done it, during work hours, or you've done it during the day, right? If your sex is something you only do at night, right before you go to bed, now you've done it in the day. Ooh. Or you've done it in the kitchen, or in the bathroom, in the shower. I mean, whatever it is, it's like you're still, you're still persevering your marital vows, and you're still not doing anything to upend Western civilization or even Mormon civilization, but you're doing it in a way that within that confine is still incredibly arousing.
Yeah, no, I agree. And when people give themselves that permission, it's fun how you say guilty pleasure versus like astounding religious guilt, that can be quite paralyzing, but when people can reframe it in that sense, then that can be such a helpful way to go and to really be playful and have fun and explore.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, all that's really critical.
Yeah, for sure. I might include some of this back in the interview. I might edit some of this in. I'm still recording. I mean, I didn't turn off the recorder, so.
Right.
I like that last piece that you mentioned.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. And I hope I didn't take too much of your time. I know time is super valuable, but this is, have you written anything? I mean, this is good.
Oh God, I've written a lot. It just really depends. I mean, I haven't written anything really for a lay audience, but, although I should, I'm going to send you this. I just wrote, and now it's in press. It's almost out. It'll be out in October, but, I wrote a piece about women's orgasm and about the clitoral versus vaginal distinction, which I think you might love. So I'll definitely drop that. And it's written for people who don't know anything about orgasm.
That's a lot of my people.
So it's kind of a cool thing, and you'll probably glean a lot of interesting information about it. There's also kind of embedded in it a big joke about Star Wars.
Oh, funny. Now, is this coming out in a month? Like this October?
Yeah,
okay.
But I can send you a preprint of it.
And is it a book or like a...
No. It's a paper.
Okay.
But
more geared towards the lay audience.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But Would you ever be willing to do this again?
Sure. Yeah, sure. Okay. But I mean, a little bit more, not completely. It's not geared really toward a lay audience as much as it's toward people that are not kind of studying the neurobiology of orgasm.
Okay.
Okay. Right. So I think you might. I'll send you a couple other things too.
All right.
But I think you might.
Well, I might hit you up for some some more podcasts if you're willing, because I really like evidence-based stuff, and
sure. Yeah. No.
It's one thing to have the feel-good stuff, and I know that's very helpful for people, but boy, when I can back it up with, especially, I guess I feel that way because I'm always so, people are always challenging me because I'm such a voice in Mormonism that's so seen as threatening almost. So if I can back it up with something significant, then I feel much more confident in saying, no, really, like, we need to change the way we think about this. And so, yeah, so fluffy stuff feels good, but it just doesn't do it for me as far as getting really to the core of what's happening in our bodies and our brains and being able to really normalize that. And Mormons tend to be very educationally focused, so they're open to that. Like, that's an avenue in, to the possibility of getting to change some of this.
It's really important. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
I think it really is. I mean, I'm reminded of one of my former postdocs, a guy named Paul Vasey, who ended up at the University of Lethbridge. And Paul, when he got there, I mean, he just had all these courses on sexuality and on alternative sexualities and stuff like that. And the largest, because, Southern Alberta is kind of like Utah, the largest number of people in any of his classes were all Mormons.
Oh, fascinating.
Right. And many of them were, already participating in alternative sexualities, and they were they're trying to get some real information.
Right.
So you know, it's you know, it's clear that that I think, you know, there's like little revolutions going on all over the place, and they're spurred on by information, real information, not BS.
Right. Yeah, no, I agree. So.
Well, and stuff that's life affirming as opposed to just, you know, it's bad, don't do that. If you do that, you'll get, we're kicking you out, we're going to shun you, or we're going to do this, or we're going to do that. You know, really, it's the stuff that is kind of life affirming,
yeah,
rather than life denying, that I think resounds with people, resonates with people.
Yeah, for sure. No, it's super important. Well, I will be in touch, and please, yes, send me materials and. Look forward to talking with you again.
All right, perfect.
All right.
Me too.
Thank you. All right. Good night.
Take care, Natasha. Have a good sleep.
Yeah,
bye-bye.
Bye.
We took the long road home. Turned minutes into miles. And as the evening traveled on, the sunset bathed your smile. We stopped beneath the desert stars, wrapped in each other's arms. Was as simple as I love you, an ordinary, extraordinary truth.
It's been a long road here, a trail. Storm, we traveled on like lovers do. And if sometimes we fell apart, we always came back home. Was as simple as I love. Extraordinary
some people say, love is blind and forever is too long. But I see your eyes in every sunrise. Can't imagine life alone. Won't you by my side till the day I die and into the beyond? It's as simple as our love is. That's how I wanna go. All wrapped up in the arms of our extraordinary, it's nothing ordinary love.
ordinary.
Ordinary.
No, it's extraordinary love.